Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Information Service here in Geneva. Today is Friday, Tuesday, 1st of July. I would like to immediately start with our topics. One point on what we have been sending you. As you know, the Secretary General is in Sevilla, where we are holding the third plenary today of the Fourth International Conference on Financing for Development. You have received a number of his statements and the press conference that he held yesterday afternoon with Pedro Sanchez, the President of the Government of Spain. We will keep you informed on other meetings that he may have. And now I have the great pleasure to connect with Tehran, where we have the honor to have the UN resident coordinator in Iran, Stefan Prichner. Stefan, thank you so much for being with us this morning with the journalist in Geneva. You are going to give us a brief on the UN development and humanitarian assistance in Iran, and then we will open the floor to questions. I'd like to say up front to our journalists that Stefan is responsible for these kind of mandates in Iran. So please keep the questions on this on these subjects, and we will hear from him first. Stefan, you have the floor. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. And can I check whether you can hear me?
We can hear you and see you well. Thank you.
Very well. Very, very nice. You can still hear me? I'm not sure whether...
Yeah, yes, we can see you very well, and we can hear you very well.
Okay, great. So first of all, very warm greetings from Tehran. Good morning, everybody. I thought I focus on three issues in my short briefing today, a little bit on how we have experienced as the United Nations Development Humanitarian System, the conflict, and then a bit on the mandate of the development humanitarian system in Iran, and finally how we adapt towards programmatically basically to the new challenges. So just as a way of context, as you all know, in the early morning hours of June 13th, a number of attacks took place in Tehran and other parts of Iran, and then over the next 12 days, there were multiple attacks by either side. As per government estimates, we know that there have been 627 people killed and almost 5,000 injured. So a really very unfortunate human toll. Many of them were civilians, reportedly. Now, this was an unprecedented adversity of for the people of Iran, as one would expect. But what we also saw on the ground is that at the same time, the people in the city, and not only Tehran, but it was in other cities, displayed a spirit of resilience. In Tehran, we could very clearly observe that, of course, from the first morning hours of that Friday, millions left the city, mostly towards the north. But there are also many stories of solidarity where we hear that people were sharing totally overcrowded apartments in those villages and towns outside Tehran's, sharing food and so on. So it's important to basically say that the people of Iran stood together. And amazingly, also the essential services in Tehran itself continued throughout the crisis. Now, how did we react to that? We immediately underlined our concern and condemnation of reported civilian casualties. We emphasized that civilians must never be the target, and that respect for international humanitarian law must always prevail. But at the same time, we were trying to adapt our programs to deliver on the most critical ones. Now, we had to make a quick decision at the beginning. We temporarily relocated our dependents' families and some of our, very few of our non-critical personnel. from the country, but it's important to really state that the UN team in Iran stayed put. We stayed to deliver. I believe that this conflict was a test for the United Nations system and its ability to adapt and program in challenging circumstances, and we stayed and delivered. Also, the work in our field offices, we have 4 field offices, in different cities, other cities of Iran, they also kept on working. This was, of course, not easy, like the population at large, our national staff, needed to take care of the families. So we adopted flexible working hours and we, kind of worked as a network of staff inside and outside Tehran. And it's amazing that the people, despite their primary responsibility of, taking care of the families, kept on working. And when internet, after a few days, was kind of more and more difficult, we used other means of staying connected. So this went very well. Now, a little bit about the mandate of the United Nations in Iran. We are covering here the issues of development and humanitarian affairs. Humanitarian is heavily focused on the issue of refugee support, given that the country is one of the countries in the world that has the biggest number of refugees in the country. And in terms of development, we have agreed in 2022 with the government on a 5-year program, a framework program on 5 pillars, which consists of public health, of socioeconomic resilience, environmental protection, disaster reduction and management, and drug control. And of course, it has to be said that in the context of Iran, the UN in Iran offers a unique comparative advantage, serving as a convener and as a knowledge provider and knowledge broker between the countries and the our host country and the international community on key fronts. Now, a little bit on the humanitarian pillar, because this is, in terms of volume, the biggest one. We have to, I would like to kind of be very clear that we appreciate the host countries hosting of a large number of refugees and Afghan population. I think it's significant that the vast majority of this group lives in urban settings together with host country communities, and only a very small share of this population is in lives in settlements, namely 1% of the Afghan population. Now, Iran has been providing for a long time access, inclusive access to healthcare and to education. Families over the last years have come, especially with girl children, to ensure education in Iran, as well as receiving other support. And the support base from the United Nations in Iran is quite large. We are working through 11 UN entities under the leadership of UNHCR, also a number of international NGOs that provide humanitarian assistance throughout different segments, such as health, education, shelter, food, and water and sanitation. Now, my third point that I would wanted to make is the impact on the conflict of the UN presence and operations. As mentioned, we stayed here throughout the conflict and are now in discussions with the government how to adapt the program to meet emerging needs that are only kind of becoming clear in these days. It's only a few days since the conflict basically has stopped and the ceasefire was agreed upon. We have to note that the institutional structure seemed to be quite strong, and essential in public services were functioning throughout the war, throughout the conflict. And I also mentioned already earlier that the resilience of Iranian people was really inspiring. And despite the trauma and uncertainty that everybody faced in the past weeks, there was a sense of community that has prevailed. So we we kind of are in the phase of reprogramming and you know kind of adopting new priorities in addition to our ongoing development programs, which are about 160 this year. But we also have immediately provided you know emergency support, such as on the health front, where you know emergency surgery kits were provided, where diagnostic kits were provided to support national diagnostic capacity, and where there was a focus on mental health and psychosocial needs as a priority. And of course, our ongoing support for refugees has continued. Food was provided to some of the settlements, and you know other targeted support for the refugee communities, especially the most vulnerable ones, you know, were continuing. So in conclusion, I would say that you know, quoting the Secretary General in his various public messages, it's very clear to us that only diplomacy can offer viable and a sustainable path. We believe that de-escalation and dialogue grounded in international law and in the UN Charter are the surest way to protect lives and preserve much needed peace in the region. But as a development and humanitarian arm, we have stayed, we're adjusting our program, and we believe that this is the time when the United Nations is most needed immediately, you know, after the ending of the conflict. And of course, we count on the support of the international community for the United Nations to be able to provide useful, timely, and effective support in these very difficult times. So with this, I would like to leave it and open and give it back to the moderator.
Stefan, thank you very much. This was extremely interesting and useful. And as I said, I mean, our journalists really wanted to talk with the UN in Iran. So thanks for being with us. I'll open now the floor to question, and I'll start here in the room. Let me see if there are any hands up. I'll start with Agnès Pedrero from the French news agency, AFP. Agnès.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. I wanted to ask you if you could give us some figures about how the humanitarian situation has evolved through last days since the conflict, how much the humanitarian situation has deteriorated, what are the needs exactly, if you could give us yes, more figures, indications on that. What are the specific needs? Thank you.
Stefan?
Yeah, the needs are definitely the kind of needs assessment is evolving. We know that the health sector has very specific needs because of, you know, the kind of hits on several hospitals, on health equipment such as ambulances, you know, so the health sector is of course overstretched with you know several thousand of injured, and we are seeing this as a focus. The next issue is at this point, of course, the refugee situation, how the conflict impacts the refugee situation. It's a bit early to basically already assess this, but what we have seen is that the returns, you know, from Iran to Afghanistan have increased, partly probably through self-evacuation, but also through deportation. So very much UNHCR and you know, and the team is in touch with you know the government authorities at different levels. To ensure that these, you know, returns are done in a planned, in a gradual and in a dignified manner.
Thank you very much. Are there questions in the room before I go to the platform? I'm looking at our journalist. Okay, so let me go to the platform. Gunilla von Ho, Svenska Dagbladet. Gunilla.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Ken.
I can hear you.
Okay, good. Thanks very much for this briefing. Interesting to have you. I'd like to know, I mean, two things. If you can describe, you talked about dead and the people who have been killed and people who have been injured. What about the destruction after the attack? Can you describe, give more concrete examples there, the impact of the destruction? The people who are injured, what kind of injuries are we talking about? If you could perhaps also describe a bit the mood among Iranians today and their thoughts about the ceasefire or worries about the ceasefire. And the last question I have is the reports about internal crackdowns, a wave of arrests and so forth. I'm not sure what you can say about this, but perhaps you
can
elaborate.
Last question.
The last question is about the reports about internal crackdowns, a wave of arrests. I am not sure what you can say about this, but if you could somehow, you know, address this, these reports.
Thank you, Gunilla. So, as I said, Stefan is really concentrating on the UN work, but I let him answer, of course.
Yeah, I can just kind of quote a few, statistics that we see from the official sources. In Tehran alone, 332 buildings have been destroyed, 3,500 housing units have been destroyed. I think what is very significant is the psychosocial impact. The Red Crescent Society reports that there are some more than 70,000 calls, where they provided telephone-based psychological counseling services to some 10,000 citizens. Very difficult to assess the mood. What I can say is that Tehran is again populated. It was a few days it was during the war, it was really completely empty, eerily empty almost, and now people are back, and which means that even in normal days we suffer traffic jams. But I would say what is amazing is these two observations that I wanted to make is that the services were functioning throughout, and secondly that people were resilient. I see this as a foreigner. People are kind as always, we know that Iranian people are famous for that. Very very kind, cultured people.
Thank you very much. Gabriela Sotomayor, Proceso.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Alessandra. Thank you for this briefing. I have two or three questions, just a clarification. If you can tell us how many refugees are we talking about? That's the first question. The second question is, If you think that this situation in Iran could help to visibilize the situation of women and children in the country. And also, third question is, if you are safe, how do you feel there? Thank you.
Stefan?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. So in terms of refugees, we have more than 3.5 million refugees and people living in refugee-like situations. Why are we calling this like this? Because we don't have, everybody has not been recognized as refugees, but we include them in the group of people in refugee-like situations. So this is a huge number. The total number of Afghans is up to 6 million people. Some of them have working permits, some of them have no documents, and others basically have refugee status and are registered with the government. So this is the significant number of Afghan population in the country. In terms of women and children, I'd very much like to focus support to women's rights, which obviously are human rights. There is an ongoing dialogue of the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights with the government on enhancing basically and progressively realizing women's rights, and the development part of the system is focusing on economic empowerment, but also maternal health. So there are, in all of our programs, you know, women and children are kind of mainstreamed, if you want, and are a focus area as vulnerable group, because I can confidently say that our whole program in Iran is focused on vulnerable groups, and women and children are one of these groups that we are considering as vulnerable here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't know if you also want to add how you personally feel, as if you feel safe, if you are safe.
How I feel personally. As a manager and kind of leader of the UN system, I was honestly more worried about my people than about myself. So there were definitely moments of anxiety. Currently, you know, the situation is stable. The ceasefire has held, but it's still very volatile. And we are, I would say, we have very exaggerated senses these days. Every noise in the night, kind of in a sense, you know, is waking you up. But currently, we feel safe.
Thank you very much, Stefan. Next question comes from Olivier Le Poitvin, Reuters.
Hi there. Good morning. Thank you very much for this briefing. Just a couple of questions. I just wanted to check in on UN staffing. I know that there had been some temporary removal of UN staffing due to the security situation. Have those people now returned? And in terms of you were mentioning there about healthcare being stretched. I mean, what is the situation now? Is that still the case in terms of you know, healthcare being overstretched and treating current patients? I mean, overall, how would you assess Iran's ability to in terms of coping with what happened, and have things improved, or do you still have some concerns going forward about how Iran might recover from what happened?
So the first question, some of the staff has not yet returned, and also our families have not yet returned. But we do have, you know, a good contingent of heads of agencies and international staff here, about 21 here in Tehran of us. And of course, like everywhere, the United Nations system also relies on the national staff. And the national staff basically is back at Tehran, and we, and also in the field offices, and we have, you know, restarted our operations, our normal operations in the office day before yesterday. Very difficult to see. The health system is very robust, but I think it's about, you know, certain things that may be needed, which we are currently assessing under the leadership of WHO. We're just basically preparing, you know, and needs assessment in collaboration with the Ministry of Health and other, you know, partners to be able to roll out, you know, very focused support. So this would be my two answers to this question. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Still many questions. Stefan, please let me know how much time you have. If you have to leave, tell us. But the next one is Nick Amin-Bruce, New York Times.
Thank you. Thank you for the briefing. Yes, you mentioned that the UN wanted to see a kind of measured and dignified return of refugees. That seems to be sort of conspicuously absent at the moment, given the huge numbers that are going across the border to Afghanistan. I wondered if you could say, why is this happening now? I mean, those refugees have been there a long time. Is there, as a response to the 12-day war, a desire suddenly to reduce dramatically the number of refugees in the country? What is the policy? Is there a target for the number of people they want to get rid of, or the number of people they're prepared to keep? And which agencies really are directing this exodus? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So the discussion on basically reducing the number of refugees has started long before the the 12-day conflict. And it was announced at the Iranian New Year. And since then, basically, you know, there was the returns were happening. Of course, they have been increasing in terms of numbers, you know, in recent days, with I think the 26th of June being the day where the single biggest number of refugees crossed the border. Now it's we have many of those are also voluntary returns, you know, moving away from the war. But we are aware that there are, of course, also a lot of deportations. But as I said, it's not directly related to the war because the efforts of the authorities started long before the war.
Thank you very much, Laurent Sierra, Swiss News Agency.
Thank you for the briefing. So what is the relationship you have currently with the authorities? Because we could see that the authorities are quite tense with the IAEA, and they were quite also vocal against the High Commissioner Volker Türk, because they consider that the critics were not so high against the Israeli Reds. So all that ecosystem, does it have any impact on the relationship you have currently with the authorities and the way you can work on the in the country? Thank you.
So at this point in time, we don't see any impact. I think the relationship with the authorities is quite constructive. We have seen this, for example, you know, with our counterpart, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, was very helpful in terms of the relocation of our, you know, some of our staff and families. And we are in daily touch with authorities to, as I said, assess the needs. We always have to remember that IAEA is a separate part of the system, and you know, has very little to do with the operations of the United Nations country team in the country.
Stefan, thank you. We have a question now from Christian Ehrlich, the German news agency.
Guten Tag, Herr Priesner. My question is on the figures again. Can you tell us how many international and local staff work for the UN system in Iran? And what is your budget? How are you affected, or are you affected by cuts? Are you meeting the budgets that you need, or is there a problem? Maybe you can give us some figures. Thank you.
Can you restate your question regarding the budget, how it's affected?
Could you tell us what your budget is, yeah, and whether you have the funds to pay for what you need to pay, or are you affected by budget cuts and maybe not enough money coming in through donations?
Okay, so the staffing is that we have 18 agencies, 14 on the ground, four basically working from abroad with projects in the country. And in total, we have a staffing of about 50 internationals and 500 nationals in the largest agencies, UNHCR. And, you know, there are some very small agencies as well. This very much depends on the work program of the different agencies. And because the refugee issue is so huge, you know, there is some of the agencies basically that deal with the refugee issues are also quite large. Regarding funding, you know, there has been a funding crisis for quite a while. This has to do with, you know, certain geopolitical relationships. Our budget last year that we delivered was about $75 million. 50 million for the refugee crisis, which is we were always calling for increased burden sharing of the international community to enable us to support you know this issue more. and about 25 million development program. And also there we have, you know, especially in environmental issues, this is common public goods, and there a lot more would be needed to address climate change issues, adaptation and mitigation. Thank you.
Pan, we are really putting you on the spot. I've got three more questions, if it's okay with you. And then we'll close and let you continue with your work. So Satoko Adachi, Yomiuri Shimbun.
Yes, thank you very much for doing this. I just want to follow up here the funding. The funding. How much do you expect that you need in the remaining 2025, given the new development on the ground? Thank you.
We are now doing the budgeting. It's a significant increase. We, you know, a bit early to say basically how much we exactly need, but we certainly would expect you know, a doubling of the funding.
Thank you very much. Okay, so we take the last two follow-ups from Gunilla and Christian. Gunilla.
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to ask you also about the prison, the Evin prison, the attack on the Evin prison. What can you tell us about the destruction and what happened to the prisoners? Among those prisoners, there's also Swedish citizens, so that's why it would be good to know.
You know, this is a little bit outside my kind of mandate. I think what has been reported in the media, you know, I cannot say anything more of this. Of course, it's tragic that civilians have been hit, you know, especially vulnerable civilians.
Gunilla, later on we will have Tommaso Della Lunga from IFRC together with his colleague who's the regional director for Asia and Pacific calling in from Kabul to speak about the Afghan side of the refugees, and maybe you can ask that question to them afterwards. Christiane, you have a follow-up.
Yes, just a last follow-up. You are expecting the needs to be double last year, so I guess 150 million. How much of that has come in, or where do you think that money should come from? Thank you.
Well, we'll hope that you know, the issue of humanitarian and development is still linked from other issues, and that the current crisis is a trigger for the international community to increase burden sharing.
Stefan, thank you so much. We'll close here this session of question and answer. I really thank you very, very much, because you've been answering a request from our journalists to brief them on the situation, the UN work in Iran. Thank you so much for being with us. Good luck with your very important work. And again, thanks for briefing us. And anytime, you're welcome back. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. So let me say thank you. It was a real pleasure to meet you all.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So let me go now to another continent, another country, another crisis. We are now going to go to Sudan. The World Food Programme has brought us Sean Hughes, who is the WFP's Emergency Coordinator for the Sudan Regional Crisis, and who's joining in from Nairobi to tell us about the refugees escaping Sudan, facing escalating hunger and malnutrition as food aid risks major reductions. So I give you the floor now, Sean. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, Francesca. Can I check that you can hear me?
We can, absolutely.
Excellent. Thanks to the members of the media, and thank you for this opportunity to brief you on the alarming situation facing millions of Sudanese refugees who have fled to neighboring countries to escape a brutal civil war at home. Simply put, severe funding shortfalls mean that WFP will be unable to sustain food assistance at current levels, and we fear that hunger and malnutrition among those vulnerable refugees will rise as a result. Since the war began in Sudan more than 2 years ago, over 4 million people have fled into neighboring countries. Many arrive hungry and malnourished, having endured months of trauma and deprivation before making the decision or finally finding the opportunity to flee. Most of them are women and children. When the conflict in Sudan first erupted, WFP moved quickly to provide emergency assistance to refugees fleeing to seven neighboring countries, namely the Central African Republic, Chad, Egypt, Ethiopia, Libya, South Sudan, and Uganda. This often meant rapidly expanding our operational footprint in remote border areas. In Chad, WFP quadrupled warehouse capacity near Adre to strengthen food pipelines to support the influx of refugees crossing from Darfur and to sustain cross-border operations into Sudan. In Egypt and South Sudan, just after the war started in April 2023, WFP scaled up cash assistance at borders and reception centers, enrolling eligible Sudanese families and returnees within hours of arrival to provide immediate support. Over the past 2 years, WFP has provided food, cash assistance, hot meals, nutrition support for the treatment and prevention of acute malnutrition in women and children to thousands of people fleeing daily into remote border communities with nothing more than they can carry. At the same time, WFP expanded support to host communities who have generously welcomed refugees, despite often grappling with their own food and other needs. This support has been a lifeline for millions, but now WFP can no longer sustain this level of support. Unless new funding is secured, all refugees will face assistance cuts in the coming months. In the case of four countries, that's the Central African Republic, Egypt, Ethiopia, and Libya, WFP's operations are now so severely underfunded that all support could cease in the coming months as resources run dry. In the other three host countries, South Sudan, Uganda, and Chad, the new arrivals are facing reduced rations. In South Sudan and Uganda, these reductions have already taken place. In Chad, which hosts nearly one in four of the refugees fleeing from Sudan, food rations will be reduced in the coming months unless new contributions are received soon. This is a full-blown regional crisis that's playing out in countries that already have extreme levels of food insecurity and high levels of conflict. It will leave vulnerable families, especially children, at even greater risk of hunger and malnutrition. Children are particularly vulnerable to sustained periods of food insecurity. Global acute malnutrition rates among refugee children in reception centers in Uganda and South Sudan have already breached emergency thresholds as people are severely malnourished even before arriving in bordering countries to receive assistance. WFP is calling on the international community to mobilize urgent resources to sustain food and nutrition assistance for Sudan's refugees and the host communities supporting them. Additional support is also urgently needed inside Sudan, where WFP is now consistently reaching over 4 million people per month, four times more than at the beginning of 2024. Last month alone, WFP reached a record 5 million people in Sudan. WFP remains committed to doing all we can, but we need the resources to save lives. Just over $200 million is needed to sustain support for refugees and others fleeing the war in Sudan over the next 6 months, and $575 million is required for life-saving operations inside Sudan. Ultimately, however, humanitarian support alone can never put an end to conflict and forced displacement. Political and global diplomatic action is what's urgently needed to end the fighting so that the people of Sudan may again experience peace and return home to build their livelihoods. Thank you.
Sean, thank you very much for this update. And our colleague from the UN Refugee Agency has also asked to take the floor for a small update on their side. Babar, you have the floor.
Thank you, dear Alexandra. Can you hear me?
We can hear you loud and clear.
Yeah, thank you. So just to add and complement what our colleague Sean was saying from WFP, I mean, as we know, Sudan is now the world's largest and the worst protection crisis. I mean, with the refugees, you also have millions of people who are displaced inside Sudan. Sudan is now among the countries in the world with the highest prevalence of global acute malnutrition. Evidence that we continue to see among the new arrivals in the neighboring countries. These are refugees who are fleeing Sudan. Notably, our teams observed that newly arrived children in places like Chad and Uganda arrive with above acceptable levels of malnutrition. Critical malnutrition levels are also observed at some of the main settlement and transit centers hosting Sudanese refugees, like in the Central African Republic, Uganda's other settlements, where nearly a third of children screened are malnourished, and in South Sudan's Rank Transit Center, where malnutrition rates among children under five has exceeded 15%, the 15% emergency threshold. This is not just a nutrition crisis. It also bears grave protection concerns for millions of people who have fled Sudan, now the world's worst protection crisis, as mentioned. Also, ongoing funding cuts are also worsening the situation with reduced food rations, and we heard reduced malnutrition screening and nutrition support and limited medical follow-ups due to reduced community health workers. The impact of these cuts also means the loss of key nutrition experts and staff. Without additional and urgent financial support, the food and nutrition crisis is expected to quickly get worse. Beyond food and nutrition support, critical funding shortfalls continue to hinder UNHCR's response efforts. Back to you, dear Alexandra. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Babar. In fact, thanks to both of you for putting the spotlight on this incredibly serious crisis. We have not been speaking about it for a while, so I will open now the floor to questions. I see Emma Farge, Reuters.
Hi, good morning. Sean, I was hoping you could give us a little bit more context on the funding shortages. Has it been a gradual tapering off for you of support from donors, or is it more linked to decisions to cut from the Trump administration, or both? And you mentioned that all support could cease for four of the refugee-receiving countries. How quickly could that happen? Are we talking days or weeks? What's the outlook on that? Thank you.
Sean?
Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, on the overall funding situation, I mean, I think it's clear that globally the humanitarian system is being severely impacted by reduced funding at the same time as global needs are rising. In terms of attribution to the US, I'd like to say clearly that the US has been very generous and a long-term supporter of both WFP globally, but also in Sudan, and continues to remain committed, and is still the largest donor for WFP in Sudan. But what we see is a culmination of reductions in humanitarian commitments from a number of donors at the same time as needs are continue to increase. And of course, this is a sustained crisis, and therefore it requires sustained commitment. Unless and until diplomatic solutions provide the ability for Sudanese to prosper and to go home and to live in peace and to resume livelihoods, the fallout will be of humanitarian nature, and that will require sustained humanitarian financing, and it's that level of requirement that we are not currently receiving. Just in terms, yeah, so the different countries and the way they receive, so it varies between the different countries. So, for example, you know, in the Central African Republic, you know, it's a relatively low number of Sudanese refugees. WFP is assisting about 25,000 Sudanese refugees in the northeast, and we're in the last month or two of being able to stretch out those resources. Similarly, for the 45,000 refugees that WFP is assisting in Libya, where there are closer to 350,000 refugees that have arrived, that funding will end within the next couple of months, and the ability to provide assistance is there. Where there are the bigger caseloads, particularly in South Sudan and in Chad, the pipeline may last just a little bit longer, but already decisions are being taken to reduce the level of assistance. And again, it varies from different countries. In Uganda, there's, and my colleague from UNHCR can provide further detail, but there's nearly 2 million refugees in Uganda. Now, perhaps only 80,000 or so of those refugees would be new arrivals from Sudan. Many others are from the DRC and elsewhere. But it's one large refugee operation. And what we're seeing in that refugee operation is already the number of refugees that receive assistance has been vastly reduced to something like 600,000 from well over a million in recent months. And the amount that refugees are receiving has also been reduced, so that those that are receiving, many are receiving 25% of what a daily normal diet or minimum requirement diet would be. So it's playing out differently in different countries with different characteristics. But the sustained financing across that operation for seven different refugee operations is required under the banner of that the Sudan crisis. Thank you.
Thank you, Babar. Would you like to add something to this?
Sure. Thank you, Alexandra. Just on the funding situation, for the regional refugee response, the needs are, and it has already been communicated, I mean, we require for this year $1.8 billion. The funding gap there is 85%. So it means only 15% of the funds are available, as it was mentioned, you know. It differs in many different countries, but the largest chunk, as Sean was mentioning, needed for Chad, where we needed $700 million, is just 18% funded. And Uganda, as mentioned, is at 4%. So really, it's also an appeal as the humanitarian situation in Sudan and in the region is getting more dire for more resources to support the desperate and the vulnerable population who have been displaced within Sudan and also in the neighboring countries. Thank you, Alexandra. Back to you.
Thank you very much. Let me see if there's other question in the room. So I go to the platform. I see Gabriela Sotomayor, Proceso.
Thank you very much, Alessandra. Thank you for this information. I have one question or two. What is the, if you have an estimate of how much the funding coming from Russia or China to fund the Sudan situation, if you have any estimate on that? And the second question is for Babar. If you can confirm or if you have any more information about migrants deported from USA to South Sudan, how many are they? What is their condition? Some people say that they are in prison. If you can talk about this, thank you very much.
I'll start with Sean and then Baba.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for the question on the funding. I'm afraid I don't today have figures for WFP on exactly how much Russia and China are providing to operations in Sudan or in neighboring countries, but we can certainly follow up on that. You know, what I would say more broadly is that obviously the United Nations agency that's undergoing essentially 40% cuts in funding levels from one year to the next, it's incumbent, and it has been for years, but now it is even more urgent that the funding sources are diversified And that you know, member states that perhaps do not traditionally see themselves as major financiers of humanitarian aid globally are certainly being encouraged to come to the fore and to make contributions, not just Russia, China, also donors in the Middle East and elsewhere. Thank you.
Babar?
Thank you, Dr. Alexandra, and thank you for the question. Just to step a little bit back on Uganda, as we were mentioning about the funding levels, but let's not forget, Uganda is also Africa's largest refugee hosting countries with refugees from many other countries in the that are being hosted there. On Gabriela, your question, I don't have any information right now, but I can check if that's something that we can help you with. Thank you. Back to Alexandra.
Nick Kamimbrous, New York Times.
Yeah, thank you for the briefing. A question for Sean. You mentioned a total, I think, of requirement of 575 million for both the seven countries and for support inside Sudan. Do you have a number for how much you've received of that already? And then a second question is, given these funding cuts, are you also already losing staff to deliver the support that you would normally provide? Thank you.
Sean, you want to?
Thank you, Nick. Yeah. So just to clear on the numbers, it's 575 million is the requirement for operations inside Sudan, and an additional 200 million is the requirement for refugee operations, particularly relating to the Sudan crisis in those seven neighboring countries, even though in those countries, refugee operations may also be for other groups of refugees as well. But this is the proportion that's directly related to that. Because this is now eight different operations that we are that we're talking about, I think it's probably easier if we provide separately the exact, if you like, funding percentage and totals that is required for each of those eight operations. But needless to say that all of them at this stage are severely underfunded in terms of sustaining those operations. WFP, in response to the element of your question about losing staff, and that impacting on operations, WFP globally is undergoing a downsizing, the proportions of which have been reported elsewhere. That is placing huge pressure on the organization and its operations more globally. For now, particularly, I would say, you know, Sudan is such, you know, as a country that is the only country to have a confirmed famine currently ongoing. We're making absolutely all efforts to ensure that sufficient capacity is dedicated there. But we do need to look more broadly than WFP and across the humanitarian system, because WFP does not work alone. We work in partnership with non-government organizations in Sudan, with organizations like the mutual aid groups and the emergency response rooms. And if funding is not available for those organizations as well, then the overall operational efficiency is further compromised. And I would say that, yes, we are seeing that in Sudan and elsewhere.
Thank you very much. I don't know if Babar wants to add anything. No, I don't see his hand up. So, sorry, Emma, you have a follow-up.
Good morning. Sean, I wanted to ask about the situation inside Sudan. Maybe you or UNHCR has some information about that. There was an attempt to get food supplies into El Fasher about a month ago, and that humanitarian convoy was attacked. Has any food aid got to that area since? And what is the situation there now? Thank you.
Sean?
Yeah, Babar, if it's okay, I'll take that one as well. Sure. Thank you very much for the question. Your recollection is correct. It was the evening or early morning of the 3rd of June when a WFP UNICEF convoy was attacked in a place called Alkoma. It was on its way to deliver life-saving assistance in El Fasha. In that attack, five people were killed. Since then, there has not been further success in managing to access El Fasha, where the conditions are extremely concerning. We understand in the region of 300,000 civilians that remain in there in a city that has essentially been under siege for a year or more. Negotiations are ongoing to secure safe passage and assurances of safety for urgent humanitarian assistance to reach that area as soon as possible. WFP is fully engaged in that. We stand ready and we are striving and actively participating in establishing a safe means of providing humanitarian assistance as soon as possible in that area. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? I don't see any hand up on both platform and in the room. Sean, thank you so much for this update. It's important that we continue briefing on Sudan. And thanks to Babar for the additional information. I have to inform you that unfortunately we have had a timing problem with Alexander Mateu from the IFRC. Tommaso is still connected, so if there is any question that you wanted to ask specifically to IFRC, of course, Tommaso is there. And Tommaso, you are going to put the press release in the chat. I see you nodding. So thanks for this. We will try to connect you with Alexander. Maybe Thomas was telling me during the day if there are requests from your side. And so that brings us to our last, but definitely not least speaker. It was Claire, journalist from WMO. Claire, these heat waves that we have outside yes. our door here, right?
I know.
You're eager to hear more.
Before I start on the heat waves, before I forget, the 12th of July is the International Day Against Combating Sand and Dust Storms. WMO will be issuing its annual airborne dust bulletin, which talks about, you know, the problems, the challenges, solutions in sand and dust storms. We're getting quite a bit of interest from journalists in it. So my question to you is, would you be interested in a technical level briefing ahead of the 12th of July with one of our experts? If so, just let me know and I can organize something.
Because there's some people nodding, but we can't really see.
Okay,
the
it's fine.
On the
I'll well just to sort of let you know that it's that it is out there and I can set something up. So today is the 1st of July, which is traditionally the hottest month of the year, certainly in the Northern Hemisphere, also at global level. So it's a good moment to remind you of why the World Meteorological Organization, our members, our partners, are ramping up action against extreme heat to protect lives from what is widely called the silent killer. You know, unlike tropical cyclones, extreme heat creeps up on you. And quite often, you know, the death toll is underreflected in official statistics. As a result of human-induced climate change, extreme heat is becoming more frequent, more intense. It's something we have to learn to live with. So warnings from National Meteorological and Hydrological Services and coordinated heat health action plans are really, really, really important to protect public safety and well-being. If you've been looking at what's happening in Switzerland, you'll see, you know, the various recommendations that are being issued on, you know, what we can do to stay cool, to stay safe. This is reflected in many countries in Europe right now. Just to give you a snapshot, and I will send you the briefing notes afterwards. So heat conditions well above average temperatures are impacting many parts of the Northern Hemisphere, parts of North America, North Africa, Middle East, and Central Asia. Today, I want to focus on Western Europe because we are currently under the influence of a strong high-pressure system. This is trapping hot air from Northern Africa over the region. And as we can see, it's having a pretty big impact on the way we feel and the way we are acting. Western, southwestern Europe, both overnight temperatures, which are the minimum temperatures, and daytime temperatures, the maximum temperatures. We have seen a few monthly station records in June. We are the first day of July, so obviously we'll be monitoring the situation as it evolves. What is exceptional, and I would stress exceptional but not unprecedented, is the time of year. You know, we are first of July, and we are seeing episodes of extreme heat, which normally we would see later on in summer. Why is it happening? Various reasons. One of them is that sea surface temperatures in the Mediterranean are exceptionally high for this time of year. It's the equivalent of a land heat wave. The Mediterranean Sea is suffering a pretty extreme marine heat wave right now. And that tends to reinforce the extreme temperatures over land areas. Just to give you a few examples, and they will be in the briefing notes. So Spain, according to the National Meteorological and Hydrological Service of Spain, AMET, said there was a temperature of 46 degrees Celsius at the weekend in southern Spain. Portugal, Italy, Greece saw temperatures well into the 40s. Meteo France has issued a top-level red alert, which is danger to life, for today and tomorrow, the 2nd of July, for 16 departments, and 68 departments have an amber alert, which is the third level. Meteo Suisse also has an amber alert for most regions, including Geneva. And as I mentioned, the heat is coming up from the African continent. Morocco reported widespread temperatures of above 45 degrees Celsius during an extended heat wave in June. That seems to be subsiding this week, but the heat is coming to us. And additionally, sort of very low cloud cover. If you look out, you see blue skies, no clouds. So low cloud cover means that solar radiation freely reaches the surface, contributing to higher temperatures. So what are the impacts, and where and who do they affect most? As we all know from the World Health Organization, you know, the vulnerable, the poor, the elderly, the infirm suffer the most. They are the most vulnerable, but everybody is at risk. Yes. If you go out without water in the middle of the day to do jogging, have a bike ride, you will probably have severe health problems or even die. So everybody is at risk. People in towns and cities, more so because of what we call the urban heat island effect. This is in rural areas. You've got more greenery, more trees, which absorb the heat. Urban areas, you know, you've got concrete surfaces, which reflects it, makes the problem worse. And what can we expect in the future? More of the same, even worse. The World Meteorological Organization, we have a regional association for Europe Climate Center. It's operated by, I think, the German Weather Service, DWT. And according to their figures, more than two-thirds of the most severe heat waves in Europe since 1950 have occurred since 2000. So that is a pretty sizable proportion. Mm-hmm. We still see cold waves in winter. They are becoming fewer, further between. We still do see them, but, you know, the heat waves now are becoming the real problem. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is co-sponsored by WMO and UNEP, shows how the frequency and intensity of extreme heat events is increasing in Europe. And by 2050, about half the European population may be exposed to high or very high risk of heat stress during summer, and especially during Southern Europe and increasingly in Eastern Europe. In Eastern, Western, and Central Europe. And this is all according to the IPCC. What can we do? It's important to stress that every single death from heat is unnecessary. We have the knowledge, we have the tools, we can save lives. Extreme heat is one of the priorities of the International Early Warnings for All initiative, and we are getting much, much better at issuing warnings for extreme heat, as we are seeing at the moment. We're also getting much, much better at coordinating these warnings with action plans. So you've got the meteorological organizations will issue the red alert, the amber alert. That will then trigger coordinated action across the board, with the health sector first and foremost, but with, you know, with other sectors as well, with education, with transportation. It really is a very coordinated system, and it works. It works well. We could do better, but it works. It works very well. WHO, we work very, very closely with the World Health Organization through a joint office on climate and health, and extreme heat is indeed one of those priorities. We also work together in the Global Heat Health Information Network, and as recently as last week, we hosted a workshop in London to try to strengthen the governance of, you know, risk management of extreme heat. So sorry, that was a little bit long, but I will send you the notes with the you know, with various maps just to explain.
No, Claire, really, that was maybe a bit long, but very, very interesting. So thank you very much for this update. Quite a few questions I see. I'll start with Emma.
One for Claire, please, and later one for Tommaso. Could you just tell us what we can expect in the coming days, Claire? How's the outlook looking for this heat wave in Europe?
It depends. It depends where you live. Our advice would be, you know, this is why you need to check with the National Meteorological and Hydrological Service of the country where you live. For Meteo Suisse, their heat wave alert was until Thursday of this week. Then, you know, it will see slightly cooler temperatures. I think it's probably a similar scenario for Meteo France, but this is why we say, you know, we can't really issue a global forecast for the whole of Europe for the next 2 weeks, because, you know, there are big variations. But as I said, you know, we do have this quite intense marine heat wave in the Mediterranean, and that does have an impact. And as I said, we're the 1st of July. We've still got the whole month of July and August to get through. It's not unprecedented. You know, we did see extreme heat, certainly back in 2019 at the end of June, and I think also from memory 2023. So it's exceptional, but it's not unprecedented.
Yeah, and I can see the northern part of Europe is going, the temperatures are going down at the end of the week. Emma, you said you had another question, but it was for Tommaso, you said?
On heat, because IFRC is involved
in
that as well.
Then go ahead. Tommaso is connected.
Sure. I understand, Tommaso, that you have some teams on standby to provide aid for people suffering in the heat. Can you give us more details on what they're doing? In what situations have you intervened? Do you have any anecdotes or maybe tallies of injuries or deaths? Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Emma. Can you hear me?
We can.
Yes, okay, perfect. Thank you, Emma, for the question. Yeah, I mean, the IFRC network, our Red Cross Crescent National Society, have been mobilizing immediately, I would say, then when there is a heat wave coming. We are working together, of course, with local and national authorities in terms of preparedness, but then also, our national society have mobilized to provide safety tips, check on the most vulnerable, and support efforts to battle wildfires. When it's coming to examples from Spain, Italy, to the UK, Red Cross team are sharing health advice and safety tips, including on how to stay cool and manage sun exposure, recognize the signs of heat-related illnesses, store medication properly, and provide care to pets. Volunteers are giving out water and checking on the most vulnerable population, including people experiencing homelessness, older people, and outdoor workers. Now, if you want to have a couple of examples, two from Spain. The first, in the southern coastal city of Malaga, the Spanish Red Cross has set up a climate refuge, air condition down to low 20s to help residents cope with the heat in comfort and with company, avoiding the isolation and loneliness that extreme heat can impose as people are forced to stay indoors. The second one, again, Spanish Red Cross volunteers help people with reduced mobility cool down at the beach through their assisted bathing service. This seemingly small act can make a world of difference to help someone cool down in the heat. Another example in Greece, Hellenic Red Cross activates early action protocol before heat waves hit, and volunteers distribute water, isotonic drinks, food and sunscreen, and perform wellness checks with bike-based first aid teams. And I would say that it's the same in Italy and in other countries. Going to Turkey, again, Greece and Norway, Red Cross and Red Crescent teams are supporting responders battling fires. They are providing first aid and delivering water, food, and other essential items to affected people. As we said several times, even in the past, extreme heat doesn't have to be a disaster. Knowledge and early action make all the difference. And this is why heat action plan and preparedness plan are so critical, even at city municipal level. And of course, if you want, we can connect you for follow-up interviews with our climate experts, but also with our Cross Crescent volunteers in the countries that I mentioned. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tommaso. And just to inform the journalists that you have, as we said, put the press release on Afghanistan in the chat, so you're absolutely welcome to look at it. Other questions in the room before I go to the platform? No. Okay, so Gabriela.
Yes, thank you very much. Hi, Claire. My question is that if you can explain this phenomenon that I was reading from other people, that they are questioning because in the normal places where there is heat, like in the beach or, you know, close to the oceans and, you know, it's okay. The temperatures are very, very heat, but I mean, they are normal, you know, for this time of the year. But the cities like Rome, Paris, in Italy is Madrid. I heard that in Spain, 190 people already die from the heat wave. So what is happening in contrast of the people who live in the in the beach, close to the sea, and the people in the cities, that they are collapsing? Thank you.
Okay, just to give you a personal and practical example, in Greece, we quite often would go to stay in a simple hotel on the coast. Our friends would be at their house sort of 5 kilometers away in the local town. There was probably like a 5 degree Celsius temperature difference, plus we had the sea breeze, and it meant it was much, much more comfortable, you know, for us to live in. That's just a personal practical example. As I mentioned, a lot of it is to do with what we call the urban heat island effect. It's a pretty technical, not very user-friendly term. But basically, and there have been studies to prove this, if you're in an area where there's lots of green, lots of trees, lots of vegetation to absorb the heat and also provide shade, temperatures will be slightly lower, and then in heavily built up areas where, you know, you've only got pavements, you've obviously got traffic pollution in many areas, small apartments, not air conditioning. And that's why in many urban areas, Paris is one of them. You know, there are also in Swiss cities, there is a movement to green cities, to climate-proof urban areas. Singapore does a great job on this. So there are ways and means of doing it. In cities, a lot of people, a lot of people are in small apartments without proper ventilation. Quite a few people live on their own. You've got the problem of homelessness. So it's vulnerability. The vulnerability is higher in urban areas. For workers, manual workers who are on building sites, construction sites, in cities, very vulnerable, as are rural workers, agricultural workers. But ILO can probably do studies on, probably have studies on this, that, you know, urban workers really are, you know, at extreme risk. And that's why it has to be an across-the-board response, you know, involving labor authorities, health authorities, education authorities, and the transport sector, and the meteorological sector.
I see Gabriele has a follow-up.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. For Tommaso, do you have recommendations? Because this time of the year is a touristic season. So thousands of people come to Paris, to Rome, and they are, doing these huge lines to go into the museums. And people are, under the sun. So if you have any recommendations for museums and places of cultural places, that people are visiting. Thank you.
Yeah, Thomas.
Yeah, thank you, Gabriela. I think that is, I would go back to what I said previously. Of course, the recommendations are the same in every context, to be hydrated, manage sun exposures, and so on. I think that this is an interesting example. At the cultural city or like Paris, I'm thinking about Athens, but even Rome, Red Cross teams are exactly in the places where tourists are, and they are sharing the same health advices and tools to support people. So, for instance, tents where they can stay in a cooler situation, distribution of water, distribution of isotonic drinks. So this is. This is already happening. And of course, I would say also all the time referring to the information coming from, of course, meteorological organizations, as Claire was saying, but and national and local authorities.
Thank you. And just in case you wanted to add something, we've got Christian online from WHO. Just in case you want to say something, Christian, on the health side, just raise your hand. But I'll go to Gunilla now.
Hi, Claire. Thanks for this interesting information briefing. I just have a question on the trapping of hot air and what to expect and how countries can be prepared. When all this passes, will there be higher risk for thunderstorms, floods, landslides, etc.? How can country societies be prepared? And just I wanted to know, what is an amber alert? Thanks.
Okay. Yes, quite often, extreme heat is broken up, even if it's just temporarily, by violent thunderstorms. On my Meteo Suisse app yesterday, in fact, as I was cycling home, I was receiving alerts of violent storms about to hit the region that I was cycling through. In the end, it didn't happen. Thunderstorms are very, very difficult to predict. We call it now casting. It's, you predict in the next minutes or hours. They are very difficult to predict, and they are very, very localized. So, a thunderstorm which hit Geneva might not have hit Versoix, so they are very localized. But quite often, yes, you know, the extreme heat is broken by very, very heavy torrential rain, and it's the same law of physics. Warmer atmosphere tends to hold more moisture, so when we do get rainfall after a period of extreme heat, it tends to be heavier. Also, extreme heat is quite often, not always, but quite often associated with drought. That means when you've got very dry, dried out soil, it's less able to absorb very, very sudden rainfall. So that's why you can get flash flooding. Also in urban areas, quite often urban areas, because of the concrete, et cetera, they cannot absorb, you know, suddenly vast quantities of rain. That's why we always stress that we need multi-hazard early warnings, you know, so not just for one hazard like heat. We need it for a whole range of things because it does have a cascading effect, whether it's on air quality, whether it's on, you know, the risk of heavy rainfall afterwards and drought. Amber alert, so in Europe we have four levels. Red alert is the top, means danger to life. And as I said, in France today, there is a red alert. You have red alerts for different things. It can be for heavy rain, it can be for winds, it can be for cold, it can be for high waves. In this case, we're seeing it can be for thunderstorms. In this case, we're seeing it for heat. And then amber alert is the next one after that, followed by yellow alert. And then in the all clear, it's green. There is actually quite a good website. It's called meteoalarm.org, and that is European-wide warnings. And so that gives you, at a glance, you know, all the different alerts currently in place in different parts of Europe.
Useful. Thank you very much. I don't see other questions. No. So thank you very much, Tommaso, for answering questions on this subject. And of course, thanks very much, Claire, to update us on this situation. I just wanted to also tell you that I think Mashreen has shared the briefing note by Sean, so you have it in your mailboxes. And I also have a couple of announcements on the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, which will close its 91st session next Friday and publish its concluding observation. Human Rights Committee has been concluding this morning the review of the report of North Macedonia, which will be followed by Latvia this afternoon, Spain, Haiti, Vietnam. And of course, the Human Rights Council is continuing. And on the Human Rights Council, we have the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967, who will present you the latest report of the titled From Economy of Occupation to Economy of Genocide. And this is with the special rapporteur, Francesca Albanese. And that's going to be on Thursday at 1 p.m. in the press room. And I think this is, and you had asked also in the chat the contact with the information colleague who works in Tehran. So you can find the address is Pasha Tabrizian, our colleague from the Department of Global Communication working in Tehran. And of course, we can also put you in contact with other people there. If there are no other questions, and I don't see any, I thank you all very much and wish you bon appétit, and I'll see you in the next briefing. Thank you.